So it's June 4th, 2014, and today I'm in Alex Starr's office at Farrar, Straus & Giroux in New York. Alex has a long and distinguished history as an editor, first as assistant literary editor of The New Republic from 1991 to 1994, then from 94 to 2001 as the editor of Lingua Franca, an extraordinary publication with a truly outsized impact on the world of ideas in general, both within and beyond the academy. Later, he was founding editor of the Boston Globe Ideas section, which he ran from 2002 to 2004, and deputy editor of the New York Times magazine from 2004 to 2011, and senior editor of the New York Times Book Review, 2011 to 2012, before joining Farrar, Straus & Giroux in 2012. He has written essays and reviews for The New Republic, The New Yorker, The New York Times, London Review of Books, and other publications as well. So thank you, Alex, for agreeing to speak with me today.
Sure thing.
How did you come to editing?
Pretty inadvertently, as I imagine many editors do. I went to work at the New Republic magazine in the books section a couple years after college with sort of easy idea that I'd do it briefly and then go on to graduate school, probably in history, I wasn't sure. And really sort of liked being there and the work I was doing so much that I ended up staying for 3.5 years, really doing a combination of helping the editors work with writers, doing some editing of my own, and doing some writing. And so all of those things appealed to me. I still wasn't sure which of any of those paths I'd pursue. But certainly I learned something about how to edit by watching other people do it and, you know, picking up some of the tricks of the trade and some of the relationships with the writers that follow and everything else. So the really decisive moment was, I guess, in end of 1994, when this magazine, Lingua Franca, was looking for a new editor. And I'd pretty much reached the point where I thought I was going to move on from the New Republic and apply to graduate school or stay in Washington, D.C. and write record reviews or do something. I wasn't sure. And then suddenly this opportunity came along to edit a whole magazine. And that was very exciting and something that didn't take long to know I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about how one learns to be a good editor, or how specifically you learned to be a great editor?
Yeah, I mean, there are different ingredients. I mean, beginning at the New Republic, where I was working, you know, in specifically on essays and book reviews, many of them written by academics, but aimed at a broader audience, I really just sort of watched the people I was working for, and it so happened that the two editors at the section, the literary editor was a man named Leon Wieseltier, and there was also another editor there named Ann Holbert, both of whom were editing in the back of the magazine. And their styles are very different. You know, Leon sort of would read and sort of have very emphatic and strong ideas and phrased very colorfully and punchingly and directly, but meant to really provoke people into rethinking their ideas. And would put them in there like thunderbolts. And, you know, that was his style, and I watched him do it, and I thought, wow, you know, you can really make an impact on something that way. And it's fun. And was much more, you know, sort of let's go through the text very carefully and just make it work and, you know, really just approach it as a craftsman, you know, as carefully as possible and with, you know, the sort of highest regard for just coherence, intelligence, flow, and everything else. So, in a way, it was just watching these two people do their job very well in very different ways that started to, you know, help me see what editors do and also, you know, form my own aspiration to, you know, try to do both as well as I could.
Mm-hmm. Well, and editors do a lot of things, right? So it's not just what we commonly associate with editing. So looking at text and responding to, or talking to authors or writing the memos or whatever. There are lots of things that go into editing. Could you maybe talk about a particular, a typical piece that you edited either at Lingua Franca or at, you know, the New Republic, and what its lifespan in your care looked like, and from maybe prospecting acquisition to post-publication, if
Yeah, I mean, I should add that if two of the inspirations were these two editors and what they did, you know, a third inspiration, you know, just becomes sheer panic and uncertainty, because when I arrived at Lingua Franca, you know, I certainly knew something about how to edit certain kinds of pieces, and certainly what an editor does on the page, you know, my ideas about that were pretty well formed. But I really was, you know, woefully unprepared for editing, you know, longer pieces of journalism as opposed to essays or reviews, which is what Lingua Franca mostly consisted of. And, you know, nor did I have much experience in, you know, sort of planning out an issue of a magazine and what should be in it and what should the mix be and how do you have longer pieces and shorter pieces and different moods and textures and tones and so forth. So, you know, all that I just, you know, worked out in a kind of sink or swim way, but with, you know, with the help of the colleagues I had at Lingua Franca as well, who certainly brought a lot to it. But, you know, so there's what you learn from others and what you don't learn from others are both important to, you know, what you end up doing. In terms of the lifespan of the individual piece,
maybe if I can propose one example, and if you want to pick another one, feel free. The one that Laura Secor wrote on the Yugoslav intellectuals, which was in that quick study of anthology, and which you mentioned in the introduction, would that be a good example? I mean, it's in my field, so I'm curious.
Yeah, no, and that's certainly one of my all-time favorite pieces in Lingua Franca, you know, and you know, this is a story, you know, this is in a sense trying to look at the intellectual prehistory of the wars that tore apart Yugoslavia in the 90s, and how, in a, you know, very interesting and even very personal way, some of the tensions among various intellectuals prefigured and perhaps shaped some of the conflicts that came later. So that's the piece. And, you know, it's interesting when Laura Secor was someone who worked at Lingua Franca as an editor, you know, they're different kinds of people writing pieces for magazines, and some of them are freelancers, some of them are people who have jobs elsewhere, and some of them are editors of the magazine who also like to write. I've found it pretty hard myself to wear both those hats, you know. But thankfully Laura is someone who, you know, was writing for the magazine as well as working as an editor. But it's to say that she was just someone, you know, I knew very well and was sort of seeing every day and just had a very, you know, direct kind of conversational rapport with, you know. And I think that sort of was particularly important for a piece like this that's quite complicated and, you know, is introducing readers to a lot of unfamiliar names and ideas and stories and so forth. So that certainly helped in them. But it was really, I don't remember, you know, like where the idea first came from or, you know, how exactly we set about pursuing it, but I knew that she liked to write about issues involving history, memory, trauma, genocide, all the, you know, darkest aspects of the 20th century and so forth, and which we were still in at the time. This seemed like just, you know, very rich material for her and something that she had gotten to know people in that world. Perhaps some of them had been connected to Dissent magazine. I can't quite remember. But, you know, she had some connection with the circle of intellectuals she was writing about and just went on to pursue it, you know, just with a kind of seriousness you know, just commitment of energy and time that goes far beyond what you normally see in a piece like that. So the fact that this piece ended up being much longer than what we normally ran, you know, really went with that. And to me, it was just sort of a model in a lot of ways, in that, you know, even though, you know, she wrote it in English, I mean, it ended up being translated into Serbo-Croatian, published in a newspaper in Belgrade, and the fact that people in Serbia were, you know, learning from it about their own history, you know, for that to happen for a magazine article is pretty unusual. And, you know, it's mostly a testament to just her commitment. And I think, you know, the editing I did, you know, is basically on a piece like that involves, you know, getting the right level of detail in the right places, having a narrative that, you know, has a pretty clear sense of what the sort of high points you're kind of reaching in the story are. And, you know, also just make sure that since this is a lot of intellectual history, that the kind of ideas that these people are developing and debating are, you know, just explained very clearly and accessibly at a level that's, you know, sophisticated enough to really explain what's interesting and important about them, but not so technical as to be inaccessible to someone who's not already well-versed in, you know, all of the debates within Western Marxism of, you know, the 1960s and so forth. So.
There are a lot of people who wrote for you ended up and still do write for venues like The New Yorker. And, you know, several of them started out, or at least a couple, writing profiles that, you know, I think the profile genre in The New Yorker is also quite strong. But it strikes me that there's a subtle difference in the way that the profiles that I read under your editorship are different from those that the same writers write for The New Yorker. And so I have to attribute that to you, that difference, or I'm assuming it's an editorial difference. And so my question would be, I think, you know, I have a theory about what that difference might be, but, you know, I would like to first give you a chance to, you know, say whether you think there is a substantive difference.
Right.
And what it might be, and so that I don't put out my insane
Okay, interesting. Let me think about that. I mean, it's just the only person who comes to mind off the top of my head has been I know it was profiled in both Lingua Franca and The New Yorker, for instance, would be Slavoj Žižek, many years apart.
There
probably are others, though.
I wasn't thinking of objects. I was thinking of writers who write profiles. And the format of the profile as written by writers working with you versus writers working in The New Yorker. Although, you know, now I didn't know about the Slavoj Žižek.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is the New Yorker piece on Žižek was written by Larissa McFarker, who's a staff writer there, but was a contributor to Lingua Franca early on and wrote other profiles, you know, and pieces for us. So you could do all kinds of comparisons there. But, I suppose there are other variables other than my editing that could intervene, such
as,
you know, growing wisdom or maturity of the author over time, or lack thereof, or within, you know, magazines and institution, as well as the manifestation of, you know, one person's shadow, and so, you know, just what's your sense of audience and so forth, or how much are you being paid, how much time are you spending on the piece, you know, there are any number of factors, but, you know, I think our profiles, I would not want to say at all that there was a formula to them, but there was clearly a certain set of concerns, you know, that you wanted to, just to make sure were adequately ventilated in the piece, and I would be sort of thinking about. And so, you know, to put it, you know, perhaps a little too schematically, I wanted scenes, I wanted personality, I wanted a sense of, you know, what it's like to be with someone, but I didn't want those things to kind of take over the piece, you know, even when someone like Eugene Genovese, for instance, this extremely memorable, blunt, talking historian with very controversial ideas, whose just sheer, you know, sort of shtick value of his conversation can take you very far, but, you know, I just would never want that to be the whole piece. I'd want to feel like, you know, those the profile writer wants to kind of bring those things alive, but, you know, you really also want to kind of do your homework and really read someone's work and, you know, give the reader, you know, a bit of an education in some part of a certain field or some part of the debate and so forth. And, you know, I just always kind of go on the sort of, you know, sort of formulaic idea that, you know, kind of complicated arguments tend to have, you know, you can sort of analyze them in terms of where they come from, you can internalize their internal structure, you can analyze their consequences, and just to kind of keep each of those three elements in mind and, you know, explain where someone's work comes from, you know, explain what it is and what's in it and how it's put together, and then try to look at how it influences people or, you know, angers them or, you know, provokes them or enlightens, you know, and just, you know, just make sure that the article is somehow accomplishing those things, but without feeling at all like you're reading, there was no Wikipedia back in Lingua Franca days, but you never want to feel like you're reading a Wikipedia entry. You want to feel like everything is being dramatized. And so how does the dramatizing work as a means to kind of explaining a lot of interesting material and not as an end in itself, while still making sure it's dramatized. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be my answer. I don't know if that confirms your theory or utterly refutes it.
I think I could make it overlap with my theory, uh-huh. but I think my theory is a bit, it's a bit shallower.
There were more big words, and
But I like your theory. Yeah, my theory was that your profile, the profiles written under you, contain none of what I would call gratuitous lavender, which is detail that is for the reader rather than to develop the person who is being, you know, talked about. To give uh-huh. the reader, you know, to it's. The example that I always think of is there was a recent piece in the New Yorker on ITER, you know, that fusion reactor, and it was a great piece. I really liked it, but there was gratuitous lavender in it, which had nothing to do either with the character who was the subject being profiled, or the place, or it had bore no relation to any of the things being discussed. But you can imagine that. That the reader might like think, oh, it's got lavender around it.
right. Yeah.
And but there's, you know, there's a lot of what I would consider, you know, detail that appears trivial that is not trivial in profiles that you gave me to read. You know, that people are sitting together in a Starbucks or. The places where interactions occur tell you something about that person, and even if just to kind of humanize them when they appear monstrous otherwise, or you know the reader wants to make them monstrous and the writer just doesn't let them be comfortable rejecting them as monsters, I think your ideas were much better.
I think that is how I think about detail for the most part. I mean, I think, you know, part of it is our pieces are 5,000 or 6,000 words, you know, the New Yorker piece might be longer and so forth, so you do want to keep the detail, you know, meaningful. You know, I would say, I mean, I think our methods work really well, and we're, you know, generally pretty controlled and kind of through a certain way. You know, what we didn't do a lot of that can be interesting is just sort of pieces that are more experimentally constructed and put together, which is always risky. But when I think of, for instance, a piece Larissa McParker actually did in New Yorker about the philosopher Derek Parfit in Oxford, and the way she kind of interpolated dialogue between him and his wife into the piece in a kind of slightly mysterious way and just made that work. You know, we didn't really do much of that. I do like those kinds of more adventurous literary approaches to writing profiles when they work like that. Or for that matter, you know, we did a lot of literary conference pieces, academic conference pieces at Lingua Franca, but we never did anything quite like, Elif Fatiman's piece on the Isaac Babel conference that was in N+1 and in her book. And, you know, it's just a bit outrageous in a way that she did it, in ways that I think, definitely make a strong impression. And, you know, people thought Lingua Franca was outrageous, but we didn't do anything quite like that.
Well, and there was some McFarker's piece on Aaron Schwartz, which was basically like juxtaposition of emails, which is, you know, incredible cumulatively.
She's really been experimenting with those methods of bringing people's sort of the primary, you know, just the raw voice or the primary text into the piece in an interesting way. You know, I like that.
Yeah, no, that was a particularly extreme and yet very successful example, I thought.
Yeah.
So, you talked a bit about how there were editors who write, and you said that, you know, that wasn't something that was a primary preoccupation of yours. But is there a way that you could describe the relationship of yourself as a writer to the relationship, you know, to yourself as an editor?
There's a few different ways to look at that. I think Victor Nevasky, who is the editor of The Nation, wrote a good book about being a magazine editor that a former colleague of ours here, Elizabeth Sifton, published some years ago. And in it, I think he says something like, that there's two theories about this. You know, one is that editors are failed writers, and the other is that editors are smart writers. And, you know, failed writers insofar as you never quite succeed in putting down what you want to put down, and just, you know, feel like that's not what you're really going to do. And smart writers in that, you know, you feel like you can work with the written word all day and have a somewhat more stable, you know, life, perhaps, in all kinds of ways. So I think there's some truth to both of those insights. I like writing certain kinds of pieces and essays and reviews. I find it very time-consuming and very difficult, and at some point I realized it certainly wasn't something I wanted to do all of my life. And just wish I could find a little more time to do some of my own writing now, but it's just a hard thing to do. I think the more subtle version of your question, of course, is just in working with writers as an editor, you know, how does one's own stylistic preferences, sensibility with voice and, you know, other sort of more personal dimensions of writing, you know, interact with the process. And I think that's a tricky question. I mean, it's certainly the case that nothing could be worse than editors who want to be writing and therefore want to, you know, sort of use someone else's text as an opportunity to do their own writing. I mean, that's really an abuse of the relationship, without any question. And I'm not interested in that at all. So I think it's very important in any book to kind of understand what a writer's, you know, just voice and style and way of, you know, communicating is. And to the extent that one does, you know, propose sentences or even whole paragraphs of one's own, which one does sometimes, just really to think about how they're written and constructed in a way that's consistent with the writer's own, you know, gifts and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's something that's important. That said, and it just depends on certain kinds of projects and certain kind of writers and what their own relationship to their own writing is. There are certainly cases where, really helping not just to kind of shape but actually create prose, you know, is part of the job, and, you know, that can be very valuable. So,
does it ever, I mean, when you said the imposition of voice, I was almost thinking the other way around. Mm-hmm. When you're reading other people's writing, does it, and you're doing it with an editorial eye, does it make you a better writer, because you can see more, you can diagnostically pinpoint when something has gone wrong and how to fix it? Or does it...
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think this and this may be why, if I'm writing the novel, you know, I think it can make you a more careful writer, but that's not necessarily a better writer. So, you can become, you know, meticulously attuned to, you know, those tiniest little glitches of syntax, but also meaning and argument. And, you know, I like reading that way. But whatever, just, you know, whatever degree of just a little bit of abandon you sometimes need to really write in a way that doesn't feel too constricted and sort of tight, and, you know, I think becomes harder when you're editing. So,
can you turn off your editorial sensibility ever, or does it just stay on all the time?
You mean like reading the newspaper,
right,
and things like that? I think I can turn it off mostly. You know, I think I'm very aware of just, yeah, the different feeling of reading with a pen in my hand and not. And, you know, one of the hardest parts of being a book editor, where you're just working on manuscripts, proposals, so many things that you're processing and forming, you know, explicit opinions that have to be acted upon on all the time. One of the biggest challenges is just trying to find time for the other kind of reading, where you really are just doing it, you know, we say for pleasure, but that's really a crude way of just saying, you know, a kind of reading that just your mind is, you know, engaged in a different way.
So, mm-hmm. So I have two questions in relation to that. One is about, you said pen.
Yeah.
Could you talk about the materiality of your mode of editing, or non-materiality? Are there phases during which you have paper and, you know, obviously, apparently pen, and then you move to computer, or how do you read? What is your...
This is all changing, both because the culture is changing and because I went from doing magazine editing to book editing, which has different demands, obviously. So, my preferred method, for sure, is to print out everything, you know, and waste a lot of paper by, you know, one-sided, double-spaced, everything else, and, you know, pick up a pen and then just sort of make marginal annotations to myself that are only legible to myself as I read, and, you know, some of those might be questions or suggested rewritings, but a lot of them are just trying to kind of map it out and see what's there and, you know, how things, something is put together. And then I almost feel like I need that pen in order to think, you know, it's just part of my, you know, body in some sense, you know. And then after I've done that, I then usually put the file up on a screen and with the sort of paper copy by my side, go over it and make changes and annotations and so forth. So since I'm going over the whole text twice, which is very time-consuming for a whole book, and therefore is not, I think, what most book editors tend to do. But it's still the only way I feel like I can see what's there well enough to responsibly suggest changing it. You know? Mm-hmm.
When you said it was legible only to you, that raised the question in me, what happens to all of that, the mm-hmm. marked-up copies that you have, or don't?
Yeah, I mean, I don't keep it, I think... Once I've, I wouldn't say transcribed, more just, you know, kind of consulted it to type things on the computer, I tend to throw all that out. You know, I think there are book editors, most book editors I think I know actually use pencil and go through a manuscript and make, you know, very carefully crafted, thought out, nicely composed thoughts in the margins as they read and then, you know, pass those on to the writers. And I admire that tremendously, but neither my handwriting, or more seriously, my thought processes are, you know, clear and coherent enough on a first pass to do that. So that first iteration is really a pretty private, you know, significance, I think.
Okay. And so it's not as though one is, you know, kind of throwing away the part that is visible of one's work?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, especially now, I mean, I somewhat reluctantly now when I edit, I use this track changes program. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, has the advantage of allowing you to look to either see all the work you've done or see none of it, depending on how you adjust the settings. And
well, has this been true through? I mean, track changes hasn't tracked you through your entire.
No, I only started using it very recently. You know,
so all of that stuff is gone. The lingua franca.
Well, no, I think probably somewhere there are Word files just with edits, you know, marked on them for writers, using more just cumbersome, clumsy, you know, mechanisms of just, I'm going to put in some brackets and some capital letters and some underline and just suggest various things I want to do. I mean, that's what I used to do for magazines I worked at.
Mm-hmm. And, could you, you mentioned the editors that you worked with at New Republic. Do you have any, and that you admired them and kind of adopted mm-hmm. in part at least both of their styles. Do you have any other editorial heroes, living or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, certainly just as someone alert to ideas and writers, and yeah, I mean, Bob Silvers is pretty incomparable, and it's just incredible to me how much I rely on New York Review books, you know, just for what I'm learning about, what I'm interested in, and reading, writing I like to read, you know. You know, there are people in this profession, certainly in book editing, whether it's like Eric Chinsky and Jonathan Glassy here, there are people elsewhere, Bob Weil at Norton, Dan Frank at Pantheon, who, you know, just do a certain kind of very intelligent nonfiction book and have found a way to publish those over many years in ways that, you know, just really admire in terms of just understanding writers and ideas and publishing, how to publish, you know, just a particularly sophisticated way. So that mm-hmm. that's exciting. You know. Anyway, those are some of the people.
So you've moved around a lot in the course of your career. Do you have like a narrative of, you know, that you would give that ties all of those various moves together? That have there been changes in the profession itself that have led to them, or changes in your own sensibility, or a combination of the two? Or is it can one not construct a coherent?
That's a great question, and one I probably should put more thought into. At any given moment, the changes feel contingent for all kinds of reasons. But I think Lingua Franca did a certain kind of journalism about, used sort of writing about academia to talk about anything. But the vehicle was writing about academia and what professors and graduate students and administrators were up to. And after doing Lingua Franca for 7 years, I was very sad when I went out of business. I was probably reaching the point where I wanted to be able to edit things that just directly intervened in their subject matters, in other ways. And so I didn't always want to sort of be writing about the academy as a scene in which things happen. So in that sense, moving on then to the Globe Ideas section, which, used a lot of, we really tried to sort of, rather than, let me back up a little bit, I mean, the initial conception of the Globe Ideas section was to do something a lot like Lingua Franca, in that it would, be journalism about the arguments academics are having with each other, but in a newspaper context for a broader audience. And this was especially relevant in Boston, where there's so many campuses and so forth. When I got to the Globe, it was 2002, it was the build-up to the Iraq War, there was just so much going on in the world that was so fraught and complicated, and, working in a newspaper setting, keeping the news sort of just more in one's mind did feel important. And so, to some extent anyway, I think the section ended up being a little bit more about using academics and their expertise to illuminate, what was going on in the news. So let's get a historian to write about the British occupation of Mesopotamia in the 1920s, or, what have you. So in that sense, it was kind of working, the Globe section was kind of working with the Lingua Franca kind of materials and authors, but, moving outward from the academy into the world in some way that was what I wanted to be doing. And then when I went to the New York Times Magazine, it just kind of broadened from there, because what I was doing there was just really absolutely anything, So, general interest magazine in the most, kind of old-fashioned sense of that. So, it was nice just having that wide stage to work on. At the same time, I think I was always drawn to books and doing things that would, last longer and be sort of on a bigger scale. And so, when that opportunity came along, it felt great. And so, in some sense, there's been some kind of broadening, and both in terms of the time scales and the subject matter. I think when I got to book publishing, what struck me in comparison to magazine editing was that it was somehow both more monastic and more entrepreneurial. Because on the one hand, if you're a book editor, you can spend a lot of time with big, long manuscripts. It requires carving out a lot of time for very close attention to one thing, in a way that the frenetic atmosphere in a magazine doesn't always support. On the other hand, book editing, you are really personally responsible as a book editor for buying books and publishing them and knowing how much to spend and understanding the business and building your own list under the, with the support and tutelage of your colleagues. And so, having to think more like a monk and more like a businessman at the same time has been the challenge, but why not?
Right. So, is this the first time that you have had to think about market explicitly in the context of the day-to-day? I mean, it seems as though Lingua Franca certainly died as a result of market, but was it part of your day-to-day considerations then, or at the New York Times Magazine or the Boston Globe in a way that it is now? Or would you be able to say that perhaps in publishing more generally it's become more important, mm-hmm. or just in this segment of publishing?
Publishing in general, it may have over the long course of time, certain gentlemen businesses have become less gentlemanly, but I think that's been something that's been happening for decades, and, by the time I began any kind of career in writing, that had pretty much already happened. So, I think, for me, it's more just a kind of a difference in the structures of these different institutions. So, at least at the magazines I've worked, there was a clear sense of, what our audience is and, what's roughly congruent with that, and that puts some framework around what one does, but, you know, in a day-to-day way, actually thinking about, in any kind of detailed way about how many people are reading this or, you know, how does this relate to advertising or any of that was, you know, just really not part of the conversation. Lingua Franca had a great reputation. It certainly attracted subscribers who were professors, graduate students, administrators. I think the dream of that magazine was that because it, was meant to just tell very accessible stories about these interesting ideas, you know, it would appeal to a broader audience of people who hadn't gone into an academic career but were still maybe majored in liberal arts and still were kind of interested in what those people they'd studied with were up to or, you know, whatever it was. And, you know, that was always a harder audience to get. I think most of the subscribers to Lingua Franca who were not academics seem to be journalists who were, you know, using the magazine to get ideas for their own stories. You know? So it's just too bad that kind of crossover audience was always pretty elusive. You know, in retrospect, were there things we might have done to reach those people? And could we have been, you know, more sort of entrepreneurially minded about it? I suppose we could have, actually. But, you know, simply figuring out what the magazine is and what kind of stuff you wanted to be publishing and making it happen was more than enough to consume us. It's just in books, you are not just editing the book, you're making financial decisions that have more impact because, you know, the ratio of when you're buying a magazine article, what you pay writers varies, you know, a very, very small degree. When you're buying a book, the ratio of your highest advance to your lowest advance is vast. So you just need to know, you know, it sort of be valuing individual products, you know, in a way that just doesn't, there's no analog to that in magazine editing, really.
Mm-hmm. It nonetheless seems to be the case that to some, because you talked about trying to get that crossover audience for Lingua Franca, to some extent what you did at the Boston Globe and what the New York Times Magazine was in many respects, or it feels to me like a continuation, mm-hmm. but with perhaps more resources to send people out places. Mm-hmm. Like it was sort of like ideas were at the core, and then what you could do now was not just what academics do, which is dig through papers, but you mm-hmm. could actually, you know, send people yeah. out. And that probably costs a lot more.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, when I think about, you know, there were pieces we did about, you know, the this woman Andrea Elliott did a piece about this town in Morocco, you know, Tetouan, and you know, in part it really is taking this sort of scholarly debate about what are the sources of radicalization, you know, how do, you know, children grow up to become terrorists in North Africa or the Middle East, and there are theories about this, you know, does it have to do with networks, your social networks, or, you know, exposure to media, you know, whatever. And, you know, Lingua Franca might have done that piece as a debate among professors. It's very, very different to send a reporter to a small town in Morocco and have them, you know, spend time with the friends of people who've gone and blown themselves up in Iraq. And a piece that can kind of do that in a way that has a very powerful narrative but is really informed by these sort of urgent questions that are under debate. Yeah, I mean, that's a different kind of journalism, but one that does out of a certain set of concerns.
Are there different editorial issues that come up when you're, I mean, because that's investigative journalism mm-hmm. to some extent,
yeah.
or I mean, it is investigative yeah. journalism, but it's of, a, you know, it's not expose. it's
right.
Because they're too complicated to have a single mm-hmm. message. And
right.
So what are the editorial considerations that are different for something like, let's say, the Lingua Franca piece, so Sikor's mm-hmm. piece on mm-hmm. Yugoslavia mm-hmm. versus, you know, like hers on Romania, on mm-hmm. the tourist industry, or mm-hmm. the one that you mentioned on Hamami, or the one on the trolls in mm-hmm. Seattle and the West
yeah.
Coast. What kinds of things does one have to keep take into consideration editorially that are different for the one versus the other?
I think, you know, again, with the Times Magazine just having this kind of general interest kind of purpose, you know, you just want to feel like a very busy person on a Sunday morning can pick up the story and immediately say, oh, there's something interesting here, there's some combination of writing that catches my attention, a character, a scene, a scenario that has some sort of intrinsic appeal, and some underlying question, theme, argument that feels, you know, kind of intellectually puzzling in a way that just makes you want to think about. So, you know, you just want to, it's a lot to try to get across just even in a headline or, you know, the first paragraph. But we definitely would think a lot about how all of those elements can be present. You know, whereas a lingua franca is just sort of a different contract with the reader, really, that you know, we're sort of presuming someone who's sort of already going to be interested in things that have some importance in the academic world or, you know, something like that. And so the story can doesn't have quite the same burden to justify its existence, perhaps. But in the end, I don't think it's that different. I mean, I think, you know, there's certain, say, here's 6,000 words to tell a story and communicate something, and there's certain forms that work for that and certain forms that don't in any magazine, and you just kind of feel, you know.
You make it sound so easy. Yes, it's just, you know, one does that. Well, and on that subject, I was wondering, because you've worked with a lot of great writers, and perhaps they've also become great writers in the course of, you know, working with you. And so I'm going to say something extreme, and then you can correct for it. I mean, to what extent, what are the limits of, let's say, the editor to be a Henry Higgins vis-a-vis a writer? To what extent is there transformative power?
In the extreme cases, there is transformative power, but I think, I don't know how to draw the diagram, but, you know, the shorter the piece and the more extensive one's own comfort and familiarity with the material, you know, the greater the editor's, you know, those are sort of force multipliers or something. I mean, just the greater the editor's ability, if they want and if it's appropriate, to really reshape something, you know. So if you have like a front of the magazine, you have a little 400 word piece, quite frankly, if someone sends something in really terrible but you really want it, you can just do it, you know. You got the raw materials, you just make it work. And that's what a lot of magazine editors did. You know, the longer the piece, the more specialized the material, the more the piece relies on, you know, just by its very nature, on a kind of writer's ineffable sensibility, then, you know, the far, far, far more limited, you know, what an editor can do other than try to inspire and exhort and cajole, maybe threaten, but not, you know, recreate. So, you know, it depends. I think, I think it's dangerous for editors to, you know, have the illusion that, you know, oh, I'm going to do all the work and save the day. That's just a kind of, you know, messiah complex that no one benefits from. But I'd be lying if I didn't say there weren't extreme cases where that is what you do and that's how you feel.
But then, I mean, I think you were talking about it in a different way than the way I meant it. You were talking about the product. I was talking about the writer. And so, you know, when you walk away from
the
product,
the Pygmalion,
because what happens, you know, I mean, if you transform a writer, they stay eloquent and they become, you know, like members of society. It's not that, you know, you've patched something up and then they go back to the gutter and, you know, maybe that's the wrong word. Can such a transformation come to pass? I mean, it's a radical example, so this is why.
Look, I think writers, one hopes over time, writers get better, you know. Philip Roth said somewhere, you know, like, you know, over 50 years, plumbers get better, you know. And that's what you're doing every day. Like, writers should get better, too. And they don't always, but often they do. And frankly, there are people who, when I read some of their earlier work, I thought they'll just never really know how to do this or really just write well, who I now read and think are great. So, it's amazing, you know, how much people can improve and so forth. You know, what catalyzes that over time, you know, it's going to be a lot of different things. And certainly having constructive feedback from an editor, and possibly just on a psychological level, just sort of, sort of trusting relationships with editors, you know, I think is really helpful to people. But it's certainly not the case that editors can say, you know, here's some secret recipe or, you know, something that you just sort of learn and then become a better writer. You know, it's just something about doing it over and over again and, you know, the combined feedback of editors, readers, friends, and just, you know, one's own evolving sensibility, you know, presumably help people get better. You know, I think there are circumstances where the task is very specific. So for a given writer, you know, the two obvious cases being academic writers who are just trying to unlearn certain habits maybe they picked up in graduate school and write, you know, more kind of seamless narrative or something like that. And, you know, just having an editor around to kind of just help them see how to do that or, you know, to realize their own goal, I think can be transformative in some ways. And similarly to people whose training is more in, let's say, in journalism, who are trying to write something that's sort of more formally and intellectually ambitious than your average, you know, daily newspaper article. And again, just having an editor as a sounding board to sort of say, you know, I think I know how to do this. Here's how I would try to do that. Is that right? You know, what about this? What about that? You know, those conversations, I think, can be important. And those are two ways in which people can change that editors can help. But it's not, you know, yeah, it's certainly not the Pygmalion thing. That, you know, it's not like that.
So another question that just occurred to me is, to what extent do you have a forensic capacity to diagnose kind of what's gone right and what's gone wrong in somebody else's final product? Like when you're reading a review, a profile, a book, whatever, can you say, oh, this was clearly, you know, done by the seat of the pants, or, you know, oh, this is 11th hour editing, or this was done, you know, with this kind of sensibility? I mean, how much can you reverse engineer the process by looking at the product?
Oh, you definitely can. It's very entertaining to do that. There's nothing that we editors like to do more than discuss with each other. Oh, did you see that piece? Here's how I think it must have happened. And, you know, and like that, to the extent there's just some shared sense of craft or whatever it is, you know, just to kind of compare perceptions to that is great. But, you know, I have to say, like, you know, when I read, I do feel like I often do try to shut that off to a certain degree. And then if something isn't sort of glaring, you know, I kind of want to forget that and just, you know, if the piece is good enough above a certain level, just imagine that it had to be the way it was, and that's all there is to it. And, you know, it might be interesting at this point to mention, you know, I work almost entirely on nonfiction, and I'm really the only, you know, my wife wrote a novel gave her some thoughts about, but mostly I work on nonfiction, and I find editing fiction, one of the reasons why I find it puzzling is I think when I read a novel, I do want to just assume that it had to be the way it was and that there were no, you know, complicated, you know, trade-offs and decisions that were made. And so the editorial process just is not intuitive to me, and I don't try to imagine it, and, you know, I just want to take it as a finished whole. You know, it's like you walk down the beach and you pick up a pebble and you might think it's beautiful or you might not, but you just assume, you know, just
some
nature made it that way, and that's what it is. And that's still the way I think about fiction for the most part. And so, you know, in that regard, I suppose nonfiction I do take apart more than that, but certain kinds of nonfiction you want to read as if they're fiction. So, yeah.
Could you parse, maybe in a general way, how much of what you do can kind of be lumped under the category of saying no versus saying yes?
That's a painful question.
painful for whom?
Yeah, well, right. Right. It would be monstrously self-absorbed to say it's me.
No, I wouldn't.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, this dilemma comes up on several different levels, beginning with just the proposals that editors field all the time and, you know, trying to figure out which ones are really worth pursuing, and you know, wanting to be sure the ones you like are things you like for the right reasons, and know what you can do with. So there's a lot of saying no in that. I mean, yeah, 90% of it is no in that level.
Like to yourself?
No, getting back to writers or agents and saying, you know, sorry, this isn't right for us. Right. So just the actual statement of no is important. And there's always these sort of tacit questions of, you know, what level of justification, you know, do you need to feel for yourself? Do you need to express to others? How do you express it? You know, what kind of reason? You know, how does sort of giving reasons work in a sort of context of, you know, engaging with someone else? You know, that's complicated. On the textual level, you know, it's rarely a case of, you know, over my dead body, no, you mustn't do this, right? But a lot of the work is, you know, just trying, you know, having an intuition about something that doesn't work or something that should be cut or somewhere where a writer's argument is just going astray somehow, and, you know, just finding ways to engage the writer, you know, in that question and in a way that you know, is completely compatible with their own values and goals, but hopefully helps them see something that isn't working. And, you know, that may not be quite what you mean by saying no, but that is the bulk of the work, really. You know, it's, you know, it's a, you know, imminent critique, as it were, you know, by your own standards, you know, how is this not happening?
Right. So we don't have tons of time left, but I did want to ask a question about the most pleasurable aspects of the process, or of maybe you could address it on a couple of levels. One, you know, has there been a golden age in your own career that you kind of return to as, ah, that was the thing? Or are there experiences that you're constantly chasing with the next acquisition that you want to replicate, and how would you characterize the experience of, you know, the high that is possible in your profession?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back to Lingua Franca, there's definitely a high to that, and that was a very particular thing of just pretty young people very scrappily putting together a small magazine with very little money and, you know, never quite knowing what was going to happen next, but the sort of camaraderie and you know, interaction of my colleagues doing that was, you know, just incredibly fun. And, you know, just, it was a sort of free, the magazine itself just had a somewhat cheeky tone, just had a kind of freewheeling, a mixture of kind of intellectual seriousness into sort of freewheeling kind of freedom to kind of do things that was just, something very satisfying in that, and having a group of people committed to that together. And so I still think back, you know, when we would finish putting out an issue of the magazine, we would usually go down to the art director's studio for two or three nights and work till, you know, very, very, very late hours together, ordering food and all that. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be doing that every night now, but I feel like that that kind of teamwork was definitely a certain kind of high. And just, you know, it was a small enough, each issue was small enough that everyone kind of knew what was in it, and you could just go around saying, what about this headline? Should we change that? And, you know, all that was great. And occasionally, you know, you'd feel like you actually had some little news scoop or something that was just very exciting to publish. You know, I think what I'm doing now is very different, the actual sort of, it's a lot of collegiality and teamwork on other things, but the actual sort of editing, you know, is much more kind of a one-on-one author-writer kind of thing without too many other people intervening. But the intensity and depth of that is sort of another kind of high. So just when you've really been through a whole book with someone and a couple times, you know, through the manuscript, and, you know, there is a kind of connection with a writer and just, you know, sort of a absorption and assimilation of sort of what's in a book into oneself that feels really rich and deep. I mean, by the most sort of selfish, you know, definition of editing anybody could give, is just like the most, you know, kind of close and intensive form of reading that's imaginable. And so, therefore, if you like reading, you know, editing is just this kind of supercharged version of it. And that's good.
Thank you. That's fantastic. One more, because I think we have...
Yeah.
I'm going to put something very broadly and then ask you to refine it. Because in looking at the pieces that I've read of yours, you know, from Quick Studies and that you recommended that I read from the other venues, it seems to me as though the core of the thing that is sacred, the thing that mm-hmm. never gets assailed, I've been trying to, you know, because you talked about lingua franca, how it was impious, and, you know, it was it had a tone that it was playful also, but it seems to me as though there is still something that, you know, that doesn't get stabbed mm-hmm. or jabbed at. And my broad assessment of what that thing is ideas, and probably not the ideas themselves, which, you know, get turned around and
right.
whatever, but that there's something kind of sacred about that they shouldn't just be trusted to anyone mm-hmm. somehow. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could refine, alter, scrap, delete that interpretation. Or is there anything
yeah,
sacred?
No, I you know, it's hard to sound too solemn about this, but thanks. I mean, I find that very flattering, and if that's your perception, and because, you know, just... I'm not sure the best way to kind of say this is, but just, you know, just some kind of I'm just taking seriously the idea that, you know, thinking hard about anything is going to be worthwhile, and that that can only happen, you know, especially in a culture like ours, you know, through certain kinds of sanctioned spaces that are, you know, allow a little more time for thinking, reading, communicating in certain ways, you know, as, you know, those are certainly, you know, completely unexamined axioms for me, so, you know, most of the, I'm trying to say, the, I think, I mean, I'm very interested in kind of liberal political thought and that kind of tradition and so forth, but I just think in that tradition there's just a kind of sense of sort of, you know, kind of the widest range of arguments, you know, sort of John Stuart Mill kind of way, the widest range of arguments need to be voiced in the public square, but you also want arguments that are serious and, you know, thought through and reflected in their formulation. Just some combination of that is very important. So.
Maybe we could go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Could you talk a bit about what you were like as a young editor and how you've changed over time in your style or approach to editing?
Yeah, I think this is a pattern you'll find with a lot of editors. I'm not certain of this. I think I was probably a little more interested when I was younger. There was a little more of a sense that, you know, your job is to kind of save the day, even if it doesn't need saving. And therefore, you know, and sometimes probably as young people do, to show off a bit, you know, mm-hmm. I know this much and I can write sentences that display it, so I'm going to just get my hands on this text and, you know, rework it. So, I think as you get older, you just learn to kind of understand, yeah, the individuality of the writers you work with a little better, or, you know, respect it a little more, and, you know, without having at all lower standards, if anything, higher standards, nonetheless, you know, try to sort of allow authors to solve problems for themselves after you point out what they are, and that kind of thing. So.
You mentioned sentences. I was wondering if, like, what you consider to be the basic unit of writing as far as editing is concerned, or mm-hmm. you know, if one could speak of that. Is the sentence the kind of level at which most of the important work gets done, or could one speak
it's a luck... Well, it depends. It can... No, I think, you know... There are different kinds of problems that texts have. There are things that are basically organize about right and say what they're meant to say about right, but the sentences just individually just don't sound right somehow. There's just, on the sentence level, the syntax just feels a little off, and then editing can be a very laborious task of just, you know, it's like, when you're woodworking, you know, doing the final stages of sanding and, you know, and so forth, and, you know, that's really what the editing is. With some writers, it works out that way. I think more often, you know, people who are professional writers can write sentences that, you know, on some basic level are work, and the problems are somewhat higher level. I think the natural unit for me, anyway, is, you know, probably like sort of 1,000 or 1,500 words of a text that's just, you know, developing a particular idea within a sort of finite space and relatively easy to hold in your head at once, and just trying to take that kind of portion and, you know, just think about how does this move from one place to another and how could it move differently, and, you know, just that might lead to wanting to cut some sentences, move sentences around, just change the way in which points are raised or addressed and so on. So that's really the kind of thinking, you know, I like to do most.
Mm-hmm. So the words you were using were related to motion, you know, kind of moving and so on. Does any of good writing or how have to do with sound? I mean, is there a poetry to good writing? Mm-hmm. Or is it mostly rhythmic, especially at the level of nonfiction?
Yeah, I don't think it's sort of sound alone ever. I definitely, you know, it's not, you know, pure poetry or something in that, some sense, but there is just a kind of, you know, how do the words and sense rhythms deliver something or unfold something, and you know, if in poetry, often the kind of the tensions between the meaning and the formal devices that are being used, you know, are part of what makes the poem work. Mm-hmm. You know, at least in most nonfiction writing, you know, you don't want an excess of that kind of conflict and tension, you know, however aesthetically rich that can be.
Right.
You do want to feel, most writers, again, not all, that, you know, a fairly economical and efficient use of certain means to deliver something is you know, underway, and you know, when material feels extraneous, you just sort of want to know, sort of feel why that is, and do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the my favorite moments in the pieces that you recommended to me is the ending of the piece on Fortuny the Trolls, and that is where it's kind of a series of kind of like pre-tweeted tweets, probably, you know, just like a discussion stream.
Yeah.
And, you know, all kinds of radical things are being said in very colloquial language, and then somebody said, you know, like empathy might have something to do with it. And it's all, you know, the author doesn't intervene there at all. Mm-hmm. And my question is, you know, can you edit such that a writer knows when to let their sources speak versus when they should, their own voice should be present? I mean, how much of that is part of the editorial enterprise?
Quite a lot. I mean, you know, and it can go either way. I mean, sometimes it is paring back the summary and interpretation and letting the voices speak, and sometimes it's the opposite. I mean, I've had texts where there's just too much just unfiltered, you know, voices from the street or whatever it is, and sometimes that can just seem like at worst someone's just sort of dumped their notebooks out onto the page, and you don't want that either, right? So, you know, you want to feel like the narrator, you always want to feel like the writer is in control and, you know, holds the reins tightly. It may be that then they've made a decision to kind of let voices speak and not, you know, comment, but you always want to feel like that's because they've arranged it very tautly in a way that works, not because they're, you know, just giving up, forming something that has its own sort of coherence to it.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So is there anything in the course of your editing career that you regret, or some mistake, or maybe the one that got away, that you think of as a kind of cautionary tale, or that comes to you sometimes for whatever reason?
Let's see. I mean, there are, you know, just in the kind of, it's really try as hard as I can to treat writers as respectfully and you know, openly as possible. But, you know, there are cases where, you know, a piece collapses at the last moment because the fact-checking doesn't support it, and then we pull it from the magazine, you know, don't get around to telling the writer and they're upset with you. You know, things like that happen, and just the wear and tear of putting out a magazine, I feel terrible about 25 years later. You know? You know, I think there's always very hard part of the job is balancing the exigencies of what, certainly in magazines, but in books too, like what's the next issue, the next manuscript you need to work on, you know, how do you balance the sort of making your deadlines and finishing the editing you need to do with being more exploratory in terms of who are the writers that really like to work with and recruit and find and, you know, help out and work with. And it's just very hard to get that balance right. And in any, I mean, the one commonality in every job I've been in editing is, you know, I felt like I did not put as much energy as I wanted into finding, you know, new writers and reaching out to people as opposed to just working with what was already there that needed to be done. And that's just a chronic problem, and just try to battle that as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Are there any professions that you see as having parallels with your own, or that are kind of like yours, but from a different angle, like to get at a metaphor, maybe, I don't know, for what you do, like the orchestra conductor, or you know, like the athletic trainer, or
right.
I don't know, or you know, maybe you'd want to take it in a different direction.
That's interesting. yeah. No, I mean, totally different metaphors, more the business side of things. When I came publishing, was I realized that being a book editor is a little bit more like being a lawyer at a law firm than it is than a magazine editor is, because you know you have the prestigious name of the firm, you hope, you have the overhead, and you have the team of people you work with, but you're kind of bringing in your own business in some sense. It's just like a partner in a law firm does, and that's very different in magazines. So that's a different kind of analogy. But
and what kind of analogy would it be in a magazine?
You know, a magazine does feel a little bit more like, you know, a basketball team, you know, people passing the ball around, getting in the net or something like that. I don't know. But that's a good question. You know, I mean, obviously people ponder the kind of writer-therapist analogy a lot.
Oh, right.
Sometimes that seems relevant to me, and sometimes it doesn't. I know an editor who was herself a psychoanalyst, and her method is to actually have writers come to her house and read their entire book aloud to her over the course of a few days while she sits quietly in the room and leaves her comments.
Oh my God.
And she does claim that this actually allows them to, you know, see things in their text they would otherwise not see, and I think that's probably right. So that is a method. I wouldn't try that myself, but in my home or anywhere, you know. But it can be done.
Does she charge them like $500 an hour?
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. They just get their advances back.
Goes around.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I find also just depends on the writer. Sometimes, you know, the boundaries between what's professional and sort of what's more personal relationship with the writer's life, you know, feel pretty stark, and sometimes not, you know, and being an editor is really participating in a great deal of someone's life, and you know, it just depends. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it must be different with magazine editing versus book editing, because in magazine editing, you're involved in their life for a very short, intense period of time, and then with book editing, you're involved for, you know, years sometimes. And so, you know, how would you characterize, you know, the nature of that relationship in magazine editing versus book editing?
I mean, with some magazine writers, you know, you do try to sort of form regular working relationships where you're, you know, trying to keep them in the magazine as much as possible, both because you like their work and because their livelihoods depend on it. So in that sense, you know, there is something ongoing. But it just doesn't have quite the same emotional complexity and depth as writing a book, where it's not just that you're part of someone's professional career over a period of time. But, you know, with books, it's really like the book itself becomes, you know, like a child or something else that's in the relationship. So, yeah, I mean, that's just a more complicated thing.
So how important is the product in the two cases, the actual thing? I mean, mm-hmm. is it that when the magazine is out, it's already over for you, basically? Or do you follow it as it goes out into yeah. the world? And is that different with books?
Yeah, I mean, it's all changing, of course, especially with magazines where, you know, it's not just publishing the article, it's figuring out, you know, do you have reader comments? Do you produce a video? Do you commission a composer to, you know, write music that plays while the reader reads it? You know, I mean, there's so many things you can do these days that, mm-hmm. you know, editors in tandem with other people, you know, play a role of, like, producers in some sense. And that's just the direction that culture's going. Mm-hmm. But it's true with book publishing, it is much more complicated where, you know, I mean, when I was first thinking about coming here, the man who hired me, you know, very sensibly said, you know, I think you would be good at editing books, but you have to understand the job isn't just editing books, it's publishing them, and, you know, how do you feel about that? And it was a good question, because it really is you are going to be the person the writer can really trust and rely upon to, you know, make sure the book reaches the right reviewers, reaches, you know, all the right places, and, you know, it's just sort of their representative in the discussions here about how to do that along with their agent. So
you have to see it through adolescence. You know, you're like, it's with you till it's 18, basically.
Yeah, and you're going to be in touch with the writer as it gets published, and, you know, when reviews get written or they go on tour, and, you know, all the different things that happen into the paperback cycle and so forth.
So, oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, so for the long haul, I guess.
Yeah.
So in the course of magazine editing and book editing, although I know you haven't been doing that for super long, and I imagine also you read a lot just as part of your profession. Maybe let's talk about that first. How do you read, and how do you decide what to read?
I mean, I think as I mentioned earlier, I mean, the hardest thing with book editing is just finding time to read things apart from your immediate proposals and manuscripts, you know, so I tend to find, I always felt when I was a magazine editor that as I was working, especially on sort of more complicated articles, I would get very interested in the subject, and but it would really only be at the moment when the article was done that I would really realize how interesting the subject was and then want to read a lot of books about it. So it was always, you know, after the work was done, I'd become fully absorbed into it. And I still find that, you know, version of that is true here. So I just finished editing a Russian novel, actually, set in... it starts with the death of Stalin and ends with the death of Brodsky, which is clearly the right proper span of time for any novel.
I saw you have Brodsky up there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No.
I had, read the Limonov piece when it came out, and I had forgotten the role that Brodsky played in his life.
Yeah,
it was a shocker, yeah.
You know, we're publishing this book about Limonov by the French writer Emmanuel Carrier. I wonder if I can find a galley for you. I'm actually, I hear it's great. I haven't read that.
Oh, wonderful.
It's kind of a biography. It's like, it's a French novelist kind of take on Limonov in a book form. And it sounds great. What was I saying? Oh, so this novel, you know, is characters sort of Moscow intelligentsia in the 50s and 60s and 70s, but as they walk down the street, you know, they're just obsessed with Mandelstam and Akhmatova and all this stuff, and so everything they're experiencing is filtered through remembered poems and so on, and I just realized I didn't know that much about those writers in those years, so to the extent I can find any time, I've been reading Hope Against Hope, and it's an amazing book, and, you know, really savoring the opportunity to, you know, fun to think about that world. You know, maybe someday have some ideas about books that could be written about that too in the future and so on.
Well, one book, if you can get somebody to write it, is on the friendship between Peter Firek and Joseph Brodsky.
Huh. Very interesting. I did not know about that.
They were, you know, because Firek is one who brought Brodsky to the, you know, basically, and who kind of sponsored him.
Yeah.
And I wish somebody, because that convergence is a weird one.
Anyway. And they stayed friendly in America.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I mean, so I guess part of what I'm saying is a lot of things I'm interested in, but often working on something will spark a curiosity, and then that becomes the basis for further, you know, reading, whether or not it plays back into my work or not. And that's one of the really exciting things about being an editor, because you're just exposed to so many things and learn more about them than you might ever expect to, and then they just give you thoughts and enthusiasms. You know, in a more practical sense, I mean, you know, I mean, I used to be ridiculous junkie, you know, newspaper and magazines, and, you know, pretty much read the entire New York Times every day, and certainly, you know, almost everything that was in the New Yorker, the New Republic, New York Review of Books, London Review of Books, et cetera, et cetera. And I just don't read them as universally as I used to. They certainly shaped, got a lot out of that. So I'm much more selective now, but I still read a lot of those same publications.
So you've read a lot, you've edited a lot, and because you've edited voraciously, you've also read, and capaciously, I would say, because, if you look at all of the different topics that have been covered in the pages of the magazines alone that you've been working with, it's basically, the time at which they are written, those are the things that are being discussed, and some of the things that aren't being discussed that you then bring into the realm of discussion. And so I was wondering if you could talk a bit about, first of all, because you've been tracking all of these things very closely, and not just tracking, but trying to shape them, what kinds of shifts you've noticed over the course of your career in, sort of the temperature of our times? What kind of times have we been living in since you started entering, and have there been marked kind of ruptures where something happened that just changed everything? And if you could end up by talking about, like, what is the moment that we're in now? What is it like? What's the texture of it?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, there's a lot to say about that. I'm not sure I can distill it, into a few simple points, but let me try to ramble. Clearly the institutional foundations of both newspapers and publishing houses and economic foundations have changed a lot in this period of time, and both become shakier and more unstable, but also in some ways freer to sort of experiment, so it's been very complicated. Clearly the internet changed a lot, but it was fairly gradual. So I don't feel like there was a kind of watershed moment or, everything changed kind of thing and so forth. But the, immediacy with which one interacts with writers as well as readers, is just greater. So the idea that one used to have to actually edit a piece on paper and, print it out and then put it in a Federal Express envelope and, send it to New York City from Washington and then have someone call you on the phone to make changes, that even that just feels, antiquated. So there's all that. I think, when I was at Lingua Franca in the 90s, it was very clear in that world that the kind of shakeups in the academic humanities were highly fraught and worthy of attention, and all these questions about multiculturalism or the canon or political correctness, there was this endless stream of stories that kind of fed into those sort of plot lines, and which trying to write about them in a more nuanced way than other people were just felt important. I often feel like if Lingua Franca had lived on after 2001, it would have been a very different magazine, just because the issues that felt most important changed a lot, and certainly in the universities, the questions about corporatization, about technology, and really the kind of ascendance, especially of the life sciences, and just all of the both the incredible intellectual progress being made and the very complicated implications of that progress, just feel really important. I'm not any less interested in questions about, say, literary canon, but they, they feel a little different in this context, and especially since I think humanities professors, I say this, talk about this a little bit in the introduction, I think, to the Lingua Franca book, realize the people who were ardent foes, 20 years ago now really have common cause in just keeping those departments alive at all, especially for smaller languages and so forth. So that's just a different context for writing about academia, for sure, but it's just interesting to see how issues that sort of feel important but a little peripheral or latent, suddenly just sort of emerge as inescapable. So for a long time it was, Islam in the West and the Middle East and the sort of fraught questions around that and just how to construe the aftermath of 9/11 and war wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, very suddenly now I just feel like the kind of politics of inequality in America and the world, too, are, you know, sort of inescapable context for thinking about things. And, you know, everyone in publishing is rightly obsessed with this Thomas Piketty book about, you know, capital, and it's just phenomenal. A book like that could be so popular. And, you know, what is it that you know, tells us? So, you know, I think what... But that's very exciting that, you know, issues like that can be handled importantly in a book form, and, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
If I could go to part of that in the issue with lingua franca, because you have said in the course of our conversation earlier that it was a creature of its time. The introduction has a bit of that. Certainly the way that everyone I've talked to, you know, narrates its kind of lifespan is that it was a creature of its time. But when I read the introduction, there was some of that, but I was expecting it to be stronger given the narratives that I had heard outside of it. And what surprised me about the introduction is that the extent to which it's clear from what you wrote that it didn't die a natural death.
Right, that's true.
It was killed. And, and you also talk about what it might have talked about if it had lived on. And do you think there is a place for... I mean, oh, let me put it a different way. Has there been a ball that you have left in the air by force of circumstance or otherwise that you think should have been picked up by somebody else and wasn't, or that, you know, kind of remains in the air sometime somewhere that you would like to take out of the air?
Yeah, I mean... You know, there's nothing exactly like lingua franca, and I do miss that for sure. I think, you know, aspects of what it did are present everywhere, from N+1 to the Chronicle of Higher Education, to name two very different publications, you know. I mean, I do think that Elif Batuman Babel piece is something that did something kind of like what lingua franca did, but just took it much further in a way, you know. And I think the Chronicle of Higher Education, which, you know, used to be very much... very dry and, you know, just sort of compendium of information, still has that quality to it, but also has a lot else in it these days. And the review section, you know, has some, you know, really interesting pieces in it, of course. So, you know, there are just sort of bits and pieces sort of scattered here and there. The Inside Higher Education website is also, you know, has good stuff in it. So, you know, there's that. I think, yeah, you know, I mean, there's certainly... certain kind of pieces I like to edit at the Times Magazine, and, you know, love to be sort of seen elsewhere, but, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think that those kinds of pieces are published in the Times Magazine anymore, and I don't know if it's money or, I mean, because that was probably costly to send people, or I don't know what the deal is, but, I mean, that kind of, you know, investigative plus ideas, you know, plus, you know, like, the gorgeousness of some of them.
Right, right, right.
They're just, you know... I don't see that happening anymore.
Yeah. Well, I have the good fortune of working with two writers who did a lot for the Times Magazine on books, so
they'll
put their energies into that. That's all good.
That is good news. So, as a historian, I have to ask you this, because you mentioned that you were trained in history and that you taught history briefly. Is there something about historical training that... you know, lends itself to a career in writing, or is there some kind of sensibility that emerges from, or have you worked with writers?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, I shouldn't exaggerate. I mean, the one thing I really wasn't trained in, much to my regret, was, you know, really sort of archival research. I think I always hesitated a bit to send my graduate student out. I filled them out, and I never sent my graduate school applications, and part of it was... other opportunities that came along in magazines, and part of it was, you know, I just never had actually done real archival research, and I didn't know what that was or if I would love it or not, you know. So the sort of question, and really that is a lot of the historian's formation. But actually, you know, it could not be more striking to me that you know, among American academics, historians seem to me the best writers in any discipline, certainly including literature departments. And
why do you think that is?
And look, obviously there's exceptions and history books, as I'm sure you know. But even if, you know, I mean, part of it is that even if, you know, social, you know, narrative history was kind of driven underground for a long time, nonetheless, you know, I think just curiosity and history and stories, you know, come, are pretty closely connected in some etymological kind of way. And, you know, just kind of some way of kind of toggling back and forth between interesting conceptual questions and, you know, the raw material of people's lives and voices and records they've left, you know, can produce, you know, writing that does not sort of spin out into, you know, entirely kind of methodological or other kind of cul-de-sacs in a way some academic writing does, for better or worse, I think. So, you know, it definitely depends on the field and the subfield and, you know, all kinds of whatever the fashion is in some small territory, but generally speaking, if I get a proposal from a historian, I have higher expectations of the writing than most other fields, you know.
Well, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I might also think that, I mean, that some historians, it's maybe more in American history than other fields, maybe don't conceptualize enough. That in fact, if in other fields, you know, social science, other social sciences are, you know, I'm sort of trying to help someone take their kind of theoretical concerns and sort of leaven them with other kinds of writing and material. With historians, you know, sometimes, you know, even now, the kind of just purely positivist idea is still very much there, and, you know, they're not always asking the right questions to make the material feel really interesting as opposed to just kind of present it. So, that's the other side of it.
So, a question on kind of academic publishing to the extent, I mean, because you have dealt with it in review contexts, and you must get a lot of proposals that come from, you know, more people experience with university presses. And so my question is, can fiscally unsuccessful, which is to say books that are going to be read by very few people, can publishing such books be defended, or should it be something, you know, like critical theory where it's subject to, you know, like a semi-pious, you know, critique, you know, that hold, you know, that says, you know, like, we should be trying harder. If only X number of people are reading it, it's just not good enough. It needs to be, and this is partly about monetary success, whether it earns its keep, but partly also about distribution, or, you know, like consumption.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there can't just be one standard of success or one norm, you know, there has to be many, and I think it may be that certain trade press houses only do books that will sell more than a certain number of copies. Other trade houses like us are more flexible in that, but we'll publish books that may not sell very many copies at all, but we just want to make sure that somehow the, you know, bottom line is not completely unreasonable. Some university presses will be looking for bigger audiences. Some will be trying to really just help fill in sort of subfields, and that may require subsidies that are very hard to get these days. So, you know, it's very complicated. I mean, obviously people propose that certain kinds of monographs should only be published on the web and so forth, and, you know, intuitively I think that would be kind of sad, but I don't, you know, I realize that the university presses are having a hard time keeping big lists of books alive, and libraries need to put all their money into buying science journals and so forth. The system is very messy. But I don't think, you know, it's always the case that it'll be a better book, you know, that I don't think it's always the case that, you know, one should always want a book to have sold not X copies, but X plus one copies, you know, and that's just a mistake. And the publisher just needs to come up with diverse kind of ecosystems in which books with different, of high quality, but of very different kinds of audiences can all survive, and, you know.
So one last question. If my ship came in and I was flush with lots of cash and I gave you, you know, $20 million and I said, you know, you're free, do whatever you like. But make it good, you know, like,
right.
what would you do?
You mean in a publishing context or in...
Actually, that would be kind of funny.
The Iranian...
if you said...
the people who make music videos in Iran or something
right,
like
I would
that,
start a
know.
Small state, yeah.
I'd probably invest in the Romanian movie industry, which, you know, seems to be really great. In fact, I will say my happiest moment as an editor was working with Scott on this piece about the Romanian and the cinema and... And, you know, we realized that, you know, the title of the piece had to be A New Wave on the Black Sea, you know, so that was
nice.
You know,
nice.
It was like, yeah, that's it. No, that was great.
Okay, well, let me yeah. add the restriction that should be in the publishing world.
I mean, I could think of all kinds of things that would be gratifying. I think the problems with publishing are systemic, and so they can't be solved by anyone's money, or, you know, it's more like how you... just create arrangements among publishers and retailers and vendors that just are sustainable long term to keep, you know, authors supported and editors supported and all that. That's really complicated and may involve, you know, the Justice Department more than getting involved.
So are you asking for more now?
Yeah, exactly. I've given campaign contributions to the politicians who will write certain bills. Maybe is my answer. But no, I mean, I would love to find just imagine some way to. I'm very interested in using it to think about certain kinds of academic projects that could be done for trade audiences in ways that maybe are a little too risky in a current environment, but that with enough capital you could sort of create a name for a certain identity for certain press and help people have the platform to reach outside the academy as an audience. That would be very appealing.
So books then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, thanks. I think our time is up. Thank you so much.
Okay, no, that was a lot of fun.